session number 28735, reel 3.
Rickman, reel 3.
One of the things that I remember so well from the Royal Arthur were the meals, and in particular Navy meals, which means what we used to call Navy duff, which is a very thick plum pudding. Not many plums in it actually, but good solid stuff, just what a young 18 year old needed, you know. And once a week, once a week, our particular batch was put on cookhouse fatigue, which meant that instead of having lessons after breakfast and so on, you went and did the washing up. Yeah. Now, for 1,000 men, this is, you had 1,000 plates, 1,000 cups, 1,000 this, that and the other, a lot of washing up. However, of course, you didn't do it by hand. About five of us spaced ourselves out along a sort of assembly line, or disposal line would be a better term. The first man picked up the plate with it and scraped off with his hand into a pig bin any muck or unwanted food there was. Passed it to the second one, who placed it in a slow-moving chain that was going along the surface. It was about 15 inches wide, was this moving surface in which there were slots, so you could slot the plate and next one and next one and next one. And as they went into a tunnel where boiling water was squirted at them and cleaned them and so on, so the job was done. The other chap down the other end had to take them out, somebody else had to put them through the dryer or what have you. You did half a morning on the preparation, getting rid of breakfast and getting lunch ready, and you didn't have your lunch until after the other chaps had been served. So when it was this didn't happen every day, of course, a helping of Navy duff, that was probably twice a week, I would think, but I look forward to that, because what you got actually was a piece of pudding which was about half the size of a brick. And consequently, because you were on cookhouse for tea, you had an extra one. So you had two of these great chunks of Navy after your meat and veg, or what have you. And one appreciated that like billy-o. Yeah. Very hungry, life-made one, you know.
You mentioned seamanship. To what degree were you learning seamanship at that stage?
Yeah, a very questionable question, that. To what extent? Certain basic aspects of seamanship are depending on finding, knowing where you are, navigation, you might say. You know about the sort of high pressure and low pressure, and let me see if I can remember it now. The centre of a depression lies 2 points abaft the starboard beam to an observer facing the wind. And now that's how, if you're at sea or on a raft or anything, and you face the wind, if there is a depression around, then it's 2 points abaft the starboard beam, it's over there. So we learnt basic weather-wise stuff, you know. Storms, clouds, because you're going to be flyers, you better know about clouds, and why they form, how they form, and all the names of the winds that go with it, katabatic, anabatic winds and so on. That's winds that blow off land when the wind is coming off the sea and onto the hot land, and therefore the air rises. So anabatic and katabatic winds, one learns about, realizes that this, wherever you happen to be in the world, will provide the weather yet your experience in that instant.
Did you learn about knots? That was one of the things I would imagine.
Oh, I see. Yes. You sold sheep shanks and yes, so on. Yes, one did. One did learn those, although I never mastered how to turn the bowline, a bowline. It is interesting in a sense, because of course we were flyers or going to be flyers, so to teach us sea stuff about how to tie knots. You don't tie knots in aeroplanes, for heaven's sake, although it's called a string bag. So I'm afraid I couldn't raise all the enthusiasm for all the subject, I suppose, that we were taught seamanship wise. Obviously, you see flags and coloured buoys and things like this that the Navy uses to as a system, semaphore again. We learned about them, and I wrote them down in a little book which I've still got somewhere called GNS, General Naval Subjects, yeah. And it's full of my scribble at the time before I taught myself to write decently after the war, do some calligraphy, you know. But the notes are still there, and the navigation, and I can't think of the word for the climate. It's not climatology, that's general weather stuff. So certain aspects to it, the side of the Navy which the Navy wanted you, because of course you see you do have to realise that the Fleet Air Arm in those days, and certainly before then, was regarded by the vast majority of naval personnel, particularly those in high command, as an absurd protuberance on the side of a Navy face. What on earth have aeroplanes got to do with ships? You can't do anything with an aeroplane. You set, get it up into the air and bring it down again. You can't. You know, big guns are what you want. You know. And how wrong they were.
Had you adjusted to the naval life? Going from civilian life into it, was it easy to adjust to?
I didn't find any difficulty in adjusting to it. You learned by watching other people senior and more advanced in experience than you were. Table manners, for example. There were arrangements of knives and forks which I didn't readily understand. Most naval officers are sent on what they call a knife and fork course that used to be held at Greenwich. If you didn't go to the main school down in Dartmouth, of course, which none of us did, just to make you worthy of the name officer with a capital O, you had to go and do this knife and fork course at Greenwich Naval College. But not all of us did, and I didn't.
I was thinking in that early stage, though, with the basic training, had you adjusted to the sort of, you know, lack of privacy and mixing with other people?
No problem at all. I was a very social person. I belonged to a social club, young youth club, you know, church youth club. So I was quite used to mixing with boys and girls, and there was no problem at all. I admit I was a bit surprised, I suppose, when the first naval establishment I actually ever went to didn't have any doors on the lavatories. For reasons that's perhaps not sensible to go into at this time of day. But apart from that, no, you just learn from others what your CO did and how he treated lesser beings and greater beings. And it was no difficulty, really. I don't think I ever put my foot in it, as it were, metaphorically speaking. There were occasions when I did not obey orders, because I thought the orders were stupid. And actually, because I was flying, of course, I was in charge of the... I was captain of the aircraft. But we may come onto that side of it a bit later on.
But generally with the day-to-day life, I'm thinking really in the basic training period, you were adjusting okay with that, were you, to change
yes,
the environment?
Yes, I didn't find anything troublesome or difficult to cope with or do in basic training, just learning parts of guns and routines connected with military business, you know.
What was the next move then after Royal Arthur? Where did you go to next?
Gosport. That's just next door to Portsmouth, of course. And we had to do trying to think how long it took, actually. It took weeks, of course. Whether it was a month or 2 months, I don't know. Something like that, yeah. And consequently... this was an even higher degree of training than we had before in some of the same subjects. Machine guns, for example, where we had to learn how to take a machine gun apart, a Lewis gun and a Vickers, and put it together again and what all the bits were for, and I could never remember what the fuse Z was, but... Still don't know, and I still don't care, because I never had the need to use either of those two guns. So you learnt a lot of things that you didn't really need, but in a sense, that's not a complete waste of time. It does mean that you are learning how to learn. It's a bit like learning Latin at school, you see. People sometimes I've heard say, what's the point in learning Latin? It's a ridiculous language. Nobody speaks it now, and you're not going to speak it when you go on holiday, so why learn it? What they don't realise is that Latin is a perfectly regular language. There are no irregularities. If you can learn Latin and learn it well, you can learn computer, IT, and learn that well, because that works on the same sort of basis. So there are other arguments for doing things other than just acquiring knowledge, if you like, as such. No.
Was this at St Vincent?
St Vincent, that's right, yes.
Were you organised then into a pilot's course at that stage?
It was called a pilot's course, yes it was, but there was no flying. No. It was purely academic. And all the marching, I mean, one had to... march the squad of 30 men that you were with around and make them wheel and turn and come into the line and so on. I got hauled up one day because I was in charge of the squad for, I don't know, 20 minutes perhaps or so. And I was marching along and happened to see the chief petty officer, famous chap whose, again, name escapes me, but...
Would that be Chief Petty Officer Wilmot?
Yes, it would. Yes, it would be Wilmot, that's right. Yeah. And he said something like, stop that squad. So I said, squad, halt! And they all halted. I said, left, turn! And they all turned and we all faced him. He comes up to me and he says, I'm going to report you, young man, what's your name? I said, Rickman's chief. Right. He said, you were allowing those men to talk in the ranks while they were marching. Not allowed. You're the officer. Right. Get them moving. And sure enough, I was hauled up before a lieutenant commander and so on. Chief Wilmot was saying, this officer cadet, sir, did not do his proper duty. His men was talking. Oh dear. I can't remember what the senior officer said, it wasn't much, but it was enough that I had been reprimanded, and you know, don't do that sort of thing again. If you're going to be a proper naval officer, you've got to abide by the rules, such as they may be.
What was your accommodation like at St. Vincent?
Big dormitories. Double bunks, one above the other, you know, separated. 24 down one side and 24 down the other, type of thing. Lino floor. Do I not know that well? Because we had to mop it, dry it, polish it, and then polish it again. Hell of a lot of housework, particularly floor work. But without wishing to be rude, even though it is, I will tell you another happening that took place which I have never seen anywhere else and not likely ever to see again. And this was called a fart lighting competition. And on the in our dormitory, well, we had to go to bed at 10 o'clock, you see. And so if you liked, you could get in your pyjamas at 9:30. There's nothing going on then. So after the evening meal, which I suppose was around about 6:30 to 7 o'clock, we would retire to the dormitory, or you could go ashore, of course, and go to a local film or pub or something. But you had to be back, of course, by a certain time. However, two of our chaps in our dormitory challenged each other to this competition. I'd never heard of it, I didn't know what they were talking about. And they said, well, when shall we have it? They said, let's have it on Thursday night, because for dinner on Thursday we always get peas or beans. And I didn't know what difference that made. However, I did notice that at the meal on the Thursday evening, two or three chaps were giving one of these participants all their peas and all their beans off their plate. Now, consequently, when we finished the meal and went back up to the dormitory, the competition started to take place. And what you had to do was to get undressed and put your pyjamas on. So, pyjama, trousers and top. You then had to get on the upper bed of the two, and you had to lie on your back and lift your legs and knees up right in the air above your head, put your hands behind your knees with a box and a match, and hold it over your anus and strike it, and then fart at the same time. And depending on the length of fart, there was somebody standing by with a ruler to measure it, you see. And I was amazed, because they not only did they manage to make the necessary noise and the necessary blue flame, because it's methane that comes out, and it's just like turning on the gas under your gas cooker. 13.5 inches. I did a drawing of that. Yeah, I don't know where it is. I lost it years ago. I dare say somebody pinched it. But the very sight of two of these chaps competing against each other, and somebody else holding a ruler out just near it, so they could get an approximate measurement, and of course 50 other chaps all looking on and making remarks at the same time, and extraordinary going on. Never to be repeated.
What was your kind of ground instruction? You said it was much the same as what you'd done before, but with a little bit more detail in there. Did it endorse things like navigation and meteorology? And
yeah,
that sort of thing?
Just more advanced. You did things in a greater detail, I suppose, is all of it, although a lot of it was was movement around. The squad drill was far more advanced than what one had done before. Similarly, arms drill, you know. It was a pain to us. We wanted to fly, we wanted to get in an aeroplane, get up in the air, and there was all this stuff about learning rigmaroles and things about matters naval which we were not likely to need or use, you know. Even in our along the service career. Obviously, you have to teach. Sorry, somebody who is teaching has to learn to take an object as a demonstration article, like a Lewis gun. Because if you're going to show people how these things come apart and how they are put back together and what to do if a bullet jams in it and so on, and that systemization of that gun or this gun is going to be very similar, no matter whether it's an old-fashioned gun or a new one. They all have their methods of assembly and methods of usage, and consequently it's that you have to be able to learn, which is going to happen to you when you start getting an aeroplane and trying to get up in the air in one. It's a matter of usage of what available material you have, you see. The only thing I suppose that I can remember from St Vincent, I can remember lots of things, of course, about it, but one sensation in a way, it was an audible one. Then, because of the squad drill, we did a lot of it. And therefore, of course, if you're going to march, you need a band. So there was always present on the days when we were doing a squad drill on a big parade ground, a bit like Horse Guards. There was a Royal Marine Band there, and it played a Life on the Ocean Wave. It put life into you. There was a swing. It imparted into the step because they were Marines, because it was a well-known tune. I don't know, I can't tell you why. It just made you want to march, and to march perfectly and in line and in step. It was a real incentive to enjoy naval life and do it well. And of course, talking about the parade ground, reminds me that one of the other things that Sir Vincent possessed, which very few stations did, was a three-masted, mast. Yeah. There was this arrangement. You see it on certain major naval occasions, but like one of the masts out of one of Nelson's battleships and so on was erected on the parade ground. So the first mast was probably 2 to nearly 3 feet in diameter across, and it went up something like 60, 70 feet. And there was onto a platform. And you, on that platform, a second mast started and went up another 60 or 70 feet, whatever, to the crow's nest. And at the crow's nest, another one went up to the button at the top. Now, these are rope ladders of the ratlin type. In other words, three or four lines coming down, slightly sloping with rope rungs, which you see on all the old tall ships, except for the last one at the top, the one up to the button. The button is on the top, and there is a T-piece, a rod going sideways and a rod going down, about 4 feet high, off the top of the mast itself. And attached to the end of the T-piece is the ladder, but it's a wire ladder, It's only about 8-9 inches apart. To what strands of wire, quite thick wire, not as thick as your finger, but getting on that way, and wooden rungs between. And that last 30, 40 feet up that, one step at a time, but don't look down, it's 210 feet down. And you get up and touch the button. And once they said, we give you a week to learn to do this, and after that week, you do it once every day. And we did it once every day, and my word, it's high. It gets you used to heights quicker than anything. Except if you happen to be a bloody-minded New Zealander, of which we had a few on course, who, having mastered the art of climbing the main brace and so on, and touching the button and all that, decided that when you're coming down, you get down to the fighting platform, that's the one below the crow's nest, the first one up, the 80-foot one, there are connections, big shrouds, huge thick wire shrouds, that hold the whole of the mast in place, and they're anchored down to the ground. Maybe there's four or six of them, those huge great wire things that are almost an inch of diameter, I think, yeah. And the New Zealanders thought they could come down on those hand over hand, no feet. And I saw one try, and he did. But in order to stop himself falling off and killing himself or breaking his leg and pelvis and all the rest of it from the 80 feet that he was up, he took the skin off both his hands. So you learn, of course, by other people's misadventures. Young men are always trying to find out what the limit is, how far can you go, whether it's with women or whether it's with things in life is another matter, but that's what you do, and that's what happens, of course, if you go too far in the wrong direction at the wrong time.
You mentioned Chief Petty Officer Wilmot, who was taking you for drill and various things like that. What were the other instructors, or who were they?
I can only remember one, and he was the one who took us for what I was telling you about. What's the word for the weather?
Is it meteorology?
Meteorology. Thank you so much. Yes, he took us for meteorology. I wish I could tell you his name. He was a Royal Navy lieutenant, I think. He might have been a lieutenant commander. He was certainly one of the prime players in the Navy's first water polo team at that time, so a brilliant swimmer. And he taught us this meteorology in particular. And one had having seen his exploits in the swimming pool, of course, as one did, yeah, from time to time, had a great admiration for his ability, particularly in water, of course. But names, I'm sorry, I ought to be able to, since he's the only one apart from Wilmot that stood out in my mind, you know, in any manner. Not that there were all that number of instructors, funnily enough, you know. I think it was Wilmot himself who was telling us how to do a few Z and the Lewis gun and things, yeah.
And was there a sense of frustration at this time? Because obviously you'd all joined up to become air crew, that you hadn't seen an aircraft or you hadn't really got involved in the flying side of things as yet?
It was, I suppose, a little frustrating. But again, that's one of the things you have to learn with service life, there's a lot of things that you have to do, which you don't particularly want to do, but it doesn't really matter that much if you don't do them, but it's better that you do, because the Navy wants you to do them. So if you go along with it and look sort of willing and able, then you get regarded with high esteem. So you do things that you don't particularly care that much about.